I looked at how the communities organized themselves from independent autonomous groups and how they organized themselves into a centralized government. And what I looked at was the North Slope Borough, a little bit at ASRC, and a little bit at the tribal government. But primarily my work ended up on political development, the North Slope Borough. And as I was doing the study on political development, it became very clear to me that there was a relationship, if not correlation, between whaling captains, traditional political elites, as I called them, and your contemporary political leaders. And from that, I moved into a study of hunting and gathering with a focus on whaling. And since that time, I've extended my studies to St. Lawrence Island to look at Siberian, or what we call Siberian Yupik Eskimo whaling. And I've just returned from St. Lawrence Island last Friday. Can I move this a little bit? Okay. For this class, a basic premise that I will argue and attempt to demonstrate to you is a relationship between the larger political and economic institutions, that is, the American institutions, the American political institutions, the American economic institutions, and its interrelationship and its influence on Alaska Native societies. To accomplish this, I will first offer you a very brief model of cultural change, and I'll be looking at the acculturation model. From there, I'll move into a review of American Indian policies, and I will briefly address the implications of American Indian policy on southeastern Alaska early history. I will conclude with an analysis of subsistence and its relationship to legislation. Okay. Unfortunately, I only have until 5 o'clock to do this. So I don't know what the usual process is that Willie has. Is that you take a break and then come back? Is that? Well, if you bear with me, I'd like to go straight until 5 o'clock. And if any of you have to leave, I'll certainly understand that. Did Willie say you guys were supposed to hand in anything? He said I was supposed to bring back some papers for him. No? But
Some people might.
Okay. Well, how about giving them to me now, those of you who do have to put that in? One? W-O-R-L. I'm with the university in Anchorage. I teach sometimes in the springtime, in fall time, but my field work takes me out in the spring, so I can't teach in the spring. But I have a full-time appointment at the Arctic Environmental Information and Data Center, where I continue to do my research, my field research. I'm a field research-oriented person and very much what we call an applied scientist. Okay, let's take a look at acculturation. There has been an increasing interest in this phenomena, acculturation, particularly in Alaska. And this stems mostly from the National Environmental Policy Act of 1971, which called for impact statements anytime that there was some kind of development that might affect the environment or people. And since that time, and since we've had the petroleum development, we've had the pipeline development, we've had OCS, we've had a number of studies that have looked at cultural change. Now, there are many different ways to look at a cultural change, but for this class, I want to focus only on one model, and that is acculturation. Understanding this phenomena is of great importance to not only the United States, but also to other European nations. As white dominance declines, the direct and forceful methods that once were used to subjugate people are no longer, they just can't do it the way that they used to. So now they're looking at other techniques of studying how do we implement change, or you know, how do we get what we want. Prior to the 1930s and World War II, there was a general assumption that Native peoples, minority peoples, ethnics would be absorbed into the larger society. And at that time, you heard a lot about the melting pot, the American melting pot. And also, there was a common belief that Indians would die out, and you often heard the theme, the vanishing American Indians. Also, the assumption was that the black problem would take care of itself, although this attitude also held that, meanwhile, they must be kept in their place. However, none of these comfortable assumptions held true, and they weren't borne out in practice. Instead, we see European immigrants sustaining themselves in ethnic enclaves. And I, you know, when I went back east to go to school, I, you know, took a look around at a lot of the viable ethnic enclaves, you know, the Irish community, different kind of communities, and you'd see these whole areas where they would just interact with themselves. So they sustained themselves. So that melting pot theory didn't necessarily hold true even for the European immigrants. For the Native Americans, we see that they resisted the assimilation or acculturation or their transformation into whites. For blacks, we see that they had a very strong group consciousness, and they also had an increasing bitterness and resentment, frustration about the economic stratification in the United States. And that attitude widened the gap between white America and blacks, and so assimilation is somewhat improbable for the blacks. Now, what is the definition of acculturation? Well, we've had various councils of anthropologists gathering together, holding meetings to try to define what do we mean by acculturation. And very basically and simply, they came up with the definition: acculturation may be defined as culture change that is initiated by the conjunction of two or more autonomous cultural systems. Simple. Okay, what does it mean? It just means that when you have culture A coming into culture B, here we have acculturation. And we may have changes going both ways. Now, that's just a basic definition of acculturation.
Can you repeat that?
Okay. It may be defined as cultural change that is initiated by the conjunction of two or more autonomous cultural systems, where we have two independent systems coming into contact. Two or more autonomous cultural systems. Stop me if you have any questions now. When we look at acculturation, there are four areas that we generally look at. I'm not going to go into any great detail on the mechanisms or the aspects. The first is a cultural system. We look at, when we're looking at the cultural system in acculturation, we look at what are the boundary maintaining mechanisms? How does that culture maintain itself? How does it maintain itself from another culture? We also look at the contact situation. What are the ecological and demographic variables? In some areas of contact, you'll see where one culture is represented by only one person, two persons. And you could see a lot of changes. The question I always have is how did Father, what's his name, Duncan from the Tsimshians, how did one man initiate so much change in the Tsimshians? So you look, you know, you look at those kind of things, the contact situation. You also look at the conjunctive relationships. What goes on between the cultures when they come into contact? I'm just going to go over this very briefly. You don't have to be worried about this. And then we also look at the cultural processes. What are the distinct steps involved? We have transmission of ideas or traits, such as Father Duncan and his transmission of religious ideologies, work habits. We also examine the evaluations by the recipients. Too often our studies are only in terms of the larger society or the dominant society. We don't analyze what are the responses, what are the attitudes of the people who are involved in the contact. And then another thing that we look at is the integration of new cultural elements into a system. How did the Eskimos adopt or integrate the rifle, the snow machine? Those are the kind of things we also look at. But for the purposes of this lecture, the most important thing that we're concerned with is dominance. When we have a dominant and subordinate relationship, we see that this relationship will affect the direction and the degree of change. So in this situation of dominance, we are looking at one culture introducing change in another culture. Now I want to give you another definition of acculturation, which I have a problem with. I view it as a biased interpretation, and I've offered my own in contrast to this one. Spindler, Louise and George Spindler, did a lot of acculturation studies, and they say that in most instances where a technologically superior group dominates a non-literate inferior group, the acculturation process is implicitly or explicitly forced. They're saying that when we have a technologically superior group, a modern mechanized society, and they meet a non-literate society who doesn't have the technological developments of the larger society, then acculturation is explicitly forced. I've turned it around a little bit from my own work, my own research, and I say, in most instances where a technologically developed system is dependent on the land and resources possessed by the indigenous group, the acculturation process is implicitly or explicitly forced. So on the one hand, the Spindlers are saying that it's the technology, the technological development that pursues or allows them to advocate for forced acculturation. And I say it's not the technological development, but rather the dependency on the resources, the kind of resources that they're trying to extract from culture B. Several different scientists have looked at change, forced change, or introducing change. We have
G-A-R-D-U-S, Orbidars,
Uy. And he says that imposed acculturation, that's what he calls it, imposed acculturation, implies one people's suppression of another people's culture and forced imposition of its own behavior patterns and idea. Linton talks about directed cultural change, those situations in which one of the groups in contact interfere and purposefully with the culture of the other. Foster, culture conquest, those situations in which the government of one cultural group has some degree of military and political control over the recipient people, and this control is utilized to bring about planned changes in the way of this group. So basically, all three of them are saying is that culture A is directing certain kind of changes in culture B. We have a dominant and subordinate relationship in terms of political power in this instance. Now, what are the various responses to this kind of change? One, we could resist, as a lot of the American Indian groups tried to do. They resisted by fighting. Another response is called a nativistic response or nativistic movement, and that is where one culture, the culture that is a subordinate culture, attempts to reinstitute aspects of its culture. And in a lot of ways, the subsistence movement, if you may, might be or could be interpreted as a nativistic response. The people view this as the last threshold to their culture, and so they're doing everything to protect that cultural element. Or another response is adoption of the dominant institutions to protect itself, and that might very well be ANGSA corporations, adoption of dominant institution. Another kind of response is controlled response.
With the adoption method, the Cherokee did that, and then they didn't succeed very
much. Yes, I know. Yeah, they became better than the white man. And so we had military intervention at that point. Another response is controlled response, and that is where one culture accepts a practice from another culture, but integrates this new practice into its own existing value system. And here again, we might be looking at subsistence and the interrelationship between the cash economy and subsistence economy. And Iser's study just recently came out, and they talk about this kind of controlled response, where they talk about voluntary cash employment, where subsistence users, subsistence hunters, adopt a cash economy but fit it to their own economic system. Now, where does this take us? I was talking about directed change, controlled change, or imposed acculturation. And here's where I get into the American Indian policy, or policies. That's 1 hour slow, right? First of all, just a few words about policy in general. There are three levels of policy, the first being a basic or long-range policy that influences the action of a government for an extended period or time. Second, the guiding principles adopted and pursued by a government during a particular or limited period of time. Third, the rules and regulations or procedural practices laid down by the government, by government administrators to implement the accepted policy. So here we have a policy that's adopted or enacted, and that policy is enacted by the legislative branch. We also see that policies can be influenced by the executive branch. And it also can be influenced and interpreted by the judiciary or the courts. And if you think about subsistence, you'll see all of these levels where we have legislation being adopted. We have administrators developing regulations. As well as fish and game boards, they are developing regulations to implement that policy. And we also see where we have had cases go to the courts for them to decide. So each one of these influences and interprets policy. That's why it's really important. A lot of people don't take the time. I mean, they think the battle is won when they go to legislature and get some legislation enacted, but they forget about the regs. And so they don't review regulations. And we find that that often these new policies are not automatically adopted because, one, they don't remove from the books all earlier laws which may prove to be in conflict with the new policy or the present policy. William Paul, and I hope you guys know who William Paul Sr. is. You guys know who he is?
Huh? Said it once or twice here.
Not really. William Paul Sr. was the first of all, he's Plinkett. He was the first person to become a lawyer, first Native person to become a lawyer, and he became very active in Native land rights before even those people who were born, you know, that guys that were involved with ANCSA, he'd been involved with a land claim for a long time. Anyway, and he was also an advocate for Native rights. And in 1946, he and the Alaska Native Brotherhood were successful in promoting the adoption of the Anti-Discrimination Act. That was in 1946. And he says, just because we were successful in promoting the passage, the enactment of the Anti-Discrimination Act in 1946, didn't mean that discrimination itself was resolved. So you can enact a policy, but then there are all sorts of other things that work to see that this policy is not implemented. It's impossible, really, to have changes in policy take effect simultaneously at all levels of government. Regulating boards and some employees, some high administrative employees, will continue to find ways to follow the practice that they think best, regardless of the accepted policies. It becomes necessary to consider policy in general, against the background of the general United States history during a particular time. And so that's what I want to talk about, is federal Indian policy and its changes over time. My thesis is, and this thesis is shared by other anthropologists, notably Spindler, the formulation of Indian policies first expressed in treaties and later enacted into legislation, was and is guided by the economic orientation of the dominant American society. The formulation of Indian policies is guided by the economic orientations of the dominant American society. That's my thesis. The need for tribal land and tribal resources has through history led to conflicts between national economic interests and hunting and gathering societies. And you see that so clearly in Alaska today, that kind of conflict. If you take a look at the North Slope and the need for petroleum and the need for hunting and gathering people or tribal groups to protect their hunting and gathering lifestyles, we see national interests pitted against tribal interests. And this has been true throughout history, American history. The evolution, the historical development of federal Indian policies has undergone dramatic transformation since its first expression by the Continental Congress in 1775. And that first policy was friendship, to secure and preserve the friendship of Indian nations. Since that time, we see in history, at least analysis of history, we see a relationship between the changing status of Indian land holdings and federal policies. There is a relationship between federal Indian policies and Indian land. As Indian land status, as Indian land holdings changed, we had changes in our American Indian policies. The first policy was friendship. In this instance, we see that treaties were initiated with Indian nations which had control over their lands, over vast tracts of lands. Lands were surrendered in exchange for compensation and also for the assurance that the United States would protect Indian lands or the lands that the Indians themselves retained. So in this first phase, this first policy was friendship. We see that in this period, the Indians were numerically stronger. They were in control of their land. But that didn't last too long. Indian matters were entwined with the problems of land needed by the immigrant settlers. In 1783, Washington observed, "The settlement of the Western country, this is the United States, and making a peace with the Indians are so analogous that there can be no definition of the one without involving consideration of the other." So the settlement of Western culture was related to establishing peace with the Indians. It went hand in hand. As the Americans gained in numerical strength, we see federal Indian policy changing from friendship to removal. And under this policies, we see the laws of removal, the laws of 1834 enacted. Here we have the establishment of Indian country. We have Indians removed from the eastern seaboard and established in areas west of the Mississippi, including the Cherokee. And this Indian removal offered the well-grounded legal basis for the Indian Service, the predecessor of the BIA. And also, at this point, we see the basis for regulating the contacts between whites and Indians. Indian Service takes over this responsibility. So we've got the Indians now west of the Mississippi living in Indian country. And the eastern seaboard guaranteed to the European immigrants. As we know from history, that didn't last too long. And so we see European and American settlers moving into the west. And so Indian country becomes, you know, not entirely Indian country. So the next policy that is adopted is reservations. Here we have the Secretary of Interior, Jacob D. Cox, in 1869 saying, "The location of the Indians upon fixed reservations so that the pioneers and settlers may be freed from the terrors of wandering hostile tribes, and second, an earnest effort at their civilization, so that they may themselves be elevated in the scale of humanity and our obligations to them as fellow men be discharged." So here we have three things going on, but here the primary thing is reservations. We're going to set up American Indians on these enclave areas. But we also get a hint of future policies, assimilation and termination. Okay, so now we've got Indians living on reservations. They're still in control of significant amounts of land.
What year was that again?
1869. Talking about reservations, the reservation policy. So now we move into assimilation policy. Okay. This time we see, you know, the Indians are living on large reservations. So the first implementation of this policy is under the Dawes Act. The Dawes Act of 1887. And extended to Alaska by the Alaska Native Allotment Act of 1906. Here we see where civilization is to be conferred upon Native Americans by allotting to them 160 acres. Okay. See, land is held in common by Indian tribes. It's not held individually. So now the Dawes Act says that we are going to start breaking up the reservations, Indian lands, into 160 acres. Farmers don't need as much land as hunters and gatherers. So within 50 years, we see some 85 million acres of surplus. Okay? This is surplus. That becomes open to American settlers. By 1934, Indian lands declined from 155 million acres to 70 million acres. The surplus land was transferred to American settlers. And even of the 70 million acres, only 30 million remained under tribal title. And that's tribal title, that's land held in common by the tribe, not individual land. That was in the, what? No, no, that was of the 70, 30 million was retained under tribal. For, you know, the difference is some is held in tribal and then some were given to individuals. And some of that was also held in trust. That's for those of you who know about Indian land allotments.
But also may have allotment act wasn't made to the acres.
No. No.
I read in a book on that, that allotment act was applied to Alaska, it said that it was extended to Alaska in 50 years later for the allotment designation.
Yes. Because by that time our government policy was already changing towards termination. Yeah, they had many applications, but they were never, the government just didn't act on them. Now, I've distinguished between, you know, policies and responses. And sometimes the responses, you know, they when they take an act, an institution, and they can sometimes utilize it to benefit themselves. And for the Alaskan scene, land allotments were beneficial in some instances. In fact, they used it to extend their land base in Alaska. Okay, so now we have this Dawes Act where, you know, they're breaking up and shifting all of the surplus over to non-natives. We see a refinement of this assimilation policy in 1934. We have the adoption of the Indian Reorganization Act. Here, for the first time, we see social scientists employed to figure out, you know, what can we do about these Native Americans that just don't seem to be assimilating. They don't seem to be leaving the reservation. They don't seem to be entering the workforce. They don't seem to be becoming educated. They were resisting change. So what did the social scientists do? Came up with a marvelous idea. They said, what we shall do is shift the initiative of change to them instead of us forcing change on Native Americans. Let's let them change themselves. So they adopted the IRA, the Indian Reorganization Act, and they offered to American Indians and Alaska Natives Western institutions, Western political institutions, Western economic institutions. They said, if you adopt these institutions, we shall support you. So we had the formation of many tribal governments, IRA governments, even though they might have had their own indigenous form of government. But now we have a government-supported institution, political institution. And a lot of tribes adopted IRA governments. And also a lot of other tribes got involved in economic development. They themselves started to organize new corporate institutions to develop, to extract the resources from their own reservation. Sound familiar? We have a further refinement of that under ANGSA. Well, I know many Alaska Native leaders will say that ANGSA offers an opportunity for Alaska Natives to maintain their cultural identity, to maintain control over their lands. We see that ANGSA is probably the best mechanism for economic assimilation. Land that can be developed under fee simple title, corporations organized to extract, to develop the resources on the land, and money to begin the development. Well, I've jumped ahead. Right after the termination policy, after the assimilation policy, the government adopted termination. Termination policy. And this was formally adopted by House Concurrent Resolution 108. And this was in 1953. Okay, what is termination? Termination is the severance of the special relationship that exists between tribal groups and the federal government. Termination. Just severance. Of trust relations. Termination. Okay, what happens under termination? Or what happens under trust? First, let's get... Yeah, exactly. The trust relationship. See, under trust lands, you cannot alienate your lands. You cannot lose your land because the government maintains that special relationship. But under termination, that relationship is severed. And for those of you who have had the chance to examine the Menominee case, the Klamath case, and many of the Colorado groups, you will see that the Indian Service or the BIA went in and actively promoted termination. They said, you know, you should vote, you know, you want to be independent. You don't want to be second-class citizens. You want to own your own land and have control over your land. So, in effect, what happened under this policy is that there was liquidation of vast amounts of tribal land holdings. Lands held by the Menominee and the Klamath. The rich timberlands, they lost most of their land. For those of you who are interested, you might want to study that and compare that with ANGSA, see if there's any kind of relationship. Menominee? I don't know. Klamath? But the Menominee, I hope Ada Deer doesn't know. I don't know how to spell Menominee. Ada Deer was the lady that was very instrumental in overriding this termination policy and getting legislation adopted so that they could become federally recognized again. Ada Deer, girl, powerful lady. So The effect of that policy is that we have liquidation of tribal land holdings. The next policy, and the policy that supposedly is in effect now, is self-determination. Self-determination and cultural pluralism. We see a reversal of termination. Oh, it was when this termination policy was in effect, when the Alaskans were applying for reservations, for land allotments, for IRA governments, that they weren't approved. In 1970, we see President Nixon, an executive branch here, declaring a policy of self-determination or cultural pluralism.
Talking about the reservations here in 1962, that thing in the Alaska News Minor about reservations, no, she was saying how it didn't work.
We had the enactment of NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act, that again talked about cultural pluralism. We see our country's ideologies changing. We see that for the first time, they are beginning to look at development in broader terms than just economic terms. They are looking at the cultural and social values of the environment as well. And in so doing that, they make a statement for cultural pluralism. For Native Americans themselves, and most specifically, we see self-determination enacted under the Self-Determination Act of 1971. Actually, the implementing regulations of Self-Determination Act look very much like the IRA. And here we have basically what the Act says is that the Native groups themselves can contract for the management of BIA and PHS programs. Most significantly, it rescinded the termination policy and reaffirmed the maintenance of the federal Indian trust relationship. And I want to point out to you that at this time, when we have a very liberal policy, we see that Indian lands have been reduced to 50 million acres. Indian lands held in federal trust are now down to 50 million acres. And the different interpretations that have been offered about ANCSA is that are that one, that it can provide real self-determination and cultural pluralism by giving natives economic and political power. That supposedly is the argument. But when one begins to analyze exactly what ANCSA does, then it looks more like economic assimilation, to the detriment of subsistence in some points. Now let's just take very quickly a look at American Indian policy in early historic years. Under the Russians, we see that they had adopted a policy that said that they would not interfere or attempt to change the lives of Alaska's indigenous groups, except to promote their own ventures in fur. Their orders from Catherine at this point in time is that you are not to interfere with the internal structure of the tribal people there. They did to an extent with the Aleuts and somewhat with the Tlingits, probably being the most successful with the Aleuts by forming schools, education, and also converting some of them to their Russian Orthodox beliefs. In Southeast, we see that the Russians were successful in directing change or implementing change in the area of theological beliefs after the smallpox epidemic. We see a number of Tlingits, I think 500 to be exact, converting to Russian Orthodox, Russian beliefs. Now the big question becomes is, and I don't know how many of you have seen the statement that I wrote on American Indian Religion or the American Indian Freedom of Religion Act, where I point out that there are many cases where indigenous people adopt new theological beliefs, but very often they maintain their own or some of their own religious beliefs. And in my research, I was really, you know, I was really surprised when I started finding this, particularly with whaling. And it becomes very evident that there is this almost uniform belief among Alaska Native groups that animals possess spirits. And unlike, you know, Western people who hold only that human beings hold spirits, they believe that animals have spirits. And this relationship, you know, with the spirits, with animal spirits, dictate a lot of their behavior towards animals. And anyway, I want to tell you about the case of the whaling thing. Was that when the quota was first adopted, and then later the controversy erupted over which quota, the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission adopted their own quota, and the International Whaling Commission also had their own quota. So they were trying to figure out which quota should they follow. And some of the younger hunters kept saying, we're going to take 40 whales. We're going to take 40 or 42 or something like that. But their belief system, their ideological beliefs say that they are never to assume that kind of power for themselves, but it's that the animals themselves that give themselves to people. And so they had violated this rule. And some of the more traditional hunters believed that to be the reason why they were not taking whales that year. They did take a few whales, but the belief was that it was those whalers who hadn't violated that rule. Okay, so basically under the Russians we have very little directed change. Although certainly we do see that there are some kind of changes in the area of religion, some education in primarily Kodiak, Unalaska, and at Sitka. But overall, it's not nothing too extensive. And probably the most pronounced change is in the area of the material cultural elements. Now, under the American era, we see a reversal of this policy from the Russian policy. Here we see that the government has already had 100 years of experience of dealing with indigenous groups, and they have their well-established policies and ideologies, which they extended to Alaska as soon as they purchased Alaska. We see the same expansionist policies. and the same assimilationist policies whereby the government is saying, we are going to extend to you the blessings of American institutions. And so the very first thing that they do is enact the Organic Act. While the Organic Act affirms the rights of Alaska Natives to their land, it also opens up land to mining. In the other area, we see the government promoting both missionaries and education. I think under the same act, the missionaries were allotted something like 640 acres. And what was that? 360 instead of 640?
Oh. That's plenty, though.
Yeah. Okay. So at this point in time, we have missionaries, educators, and sometimes the missionaries and educators were one and the same, and developers arriving in Alaska in larger numbers. Something that you don't often hear about is the response that Native Americans or Alaska Natives made to this incursion on their lands. In 1899, we have a council of Tlingit chiefs meeting for the first time to discuss the incursions on their land. So in 1899, they select one of their own chiefs to go back to D.C. and protest this loss of land. To no avail, but nothing happened. But the records show that repeatedly Southeast Alaskan Indians, and here's where, you know, initially the development occurred, we see them protesting the loss of their land. The records are filled with it. If you look at that one book that's compiled by Alaska Customs, you'll see all of these protests where they're, you know, going to the missionaries and going to the customs agent and saying, hey, our land is being lost. Okay, so that in effect, you know, promotes change. We have mining and fisheries developing in Southeast, and we see Tlingits, Haidas, and Tsimshians at this point beginning to become involved in the larger economic system. The educational policy at this time is to civilize the natives and to help them become self-respecting and independent citizens. Leadership was to be developed by creaming off the most intelligent and offering them vocational training. I think at this time, point in time, they're calling it industrial training. And offering them this training in carpentry, boat building, fish canning, and domestic sciences. This is how they were going to develop their leaders. I find it somewhat ironic that they were teaching the Tlingits and Haidas, who were masters in carpentry, masters in boat building, this trade. And also, as a, you know, I just don't think that you develop leadership that way. And certainly they had their own leadership. At this point in time, we see that this emphasis on vocational training is causing some alarm among the whites. They don't like the focus on vocational training. They say, you know, it's not good education. And also they're very concerned about integrated schools leading to inferior education. So they advocate and successfully were able to get the Nelson Act of 1905 enacted. And this Nelson Act established schools for white children and children of mixed blood who lead a civilized life. This issue of civilized becomes really important, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Also, we see at this time the predecessor of BIA, a special Alaska division created to govern Alaska. In 1907, the chief of that section says that he listed the following facts which he noted must be resolved to ameliorate the conditions of the natives. One, got to take care of the selling and giving of liquor to natives by white men. Two, illicit intercourse between white men and native women. Three, destruction of fish and game. Four, the ravages of disease. Five, disregard of the rights of natives. Okay, now let's take a look at this uncivilized or civilized issue. In the Treaty of Session, we see that the Tlingits and Haidas were classified as the uncivilized. And remember, in the Treaty of Session, they talk about independent groups and also civilized and uncivilized. Now, at this point in time, we see that the American law has not defined what we mean by what constitutes being civilized or a person of mixed blood at this point in time. However, there was a decision later, and I don't know what year that was, and this is in Sloan versus the United States. We see the question of mixed blood arising. In the decision under this case, we see mixed blood implies persons of white and Indian parentage without regard to the source of the Indian blood. In other words, mixed blood means mixed Indian blood, regardless of whether it comes from the father or the mother. So you could have mixed blood, you know, Irish and French, but that's not considered mixed. The only time that it's considered mixed is when it involves Indians. White blood may be mixed with other white blood, but it's not considered mixed blood. Okay, in 1908, we have six children applying to enroll in the Sitka Territorial Schools. Their admission was refused. At this point in time, the Tlingits bring the issue to court. And we have Davis versus the Sitka School Board. The judge, yes, did determine that they were children of mixed blood. However, insofar as the issue of civilized, we see that this status was to be tested against several criteria. And the criteria that the judge outlined as to whether or not the persons in question, the six children, have turned aside from old associations, former habits of life, and easier modes of existence. In other words, have exchanged barbaric, uncivilized environments for one changed, new and so different as to indicate an advanced and an improved condition. Okay. We see that the children were mixed blood. And let's look at their characteristics. The children were born in lawful wedlock. The children were part of a family which owned a house, their own nuclear family dwelling, not a tribal house, in the native village. And the children's playmates are presumably native children who live in the Indian village. One of the parents owned a store in which he manufactured and sold Indian curios, pays a business tax, rented a post office box, and at this time worked off his road tax. I don't know what that means. And adopted a white man's style of dress, installed a cash register, speaks, reads, and writes English, resides in a house separate and apart from other natives, clothes and supports his family and members of the Presbyterian Church. Although the judge noted that the people were industrious, law-abiding, and intelligent, he said, "I fail to find in the testimony evidence of a condition that inclines me to the opinion that the Davis have that requisite, being civilized." The judge rendered the opinion that the school board had acted within their power in refusing the six children. Walton, one of the individuals involved, one of the parents, contemplated appealing the decision that he and others did not lead a civilized type of life. However, he decided against pursuing the case because he was fearful of making enemies with the other whites. Sounds very much like the Cherokee. We have the organization of the Alaska Native Brotherhood at this time. They organized in 1912 to advocate for their political and economic rights. And also they take up education as one of their leading issues. And so they go to court again and bring another suit. This time it's in Ketchikan. And using the same arguments. And in this case, we see that the judge does make the decision not on there being civilized, but in fact, it was a de facto decision saying that they were civilized. And so these children who led civilized lives and were of mixed blood were able to go to the new school. So I'm going to leave Southeast history at that point. But I just kind of wanted to show you an example of how federal Indian policy was implemented in the earlier years in Alaska in terms of, you know, assimilationist policies. Now I want to take a look at subsistence. I got very involved in subsistence first, you know, 1975, 76, when I was doing my research up in the Arctic. And I also said that I am what I call an applied scientist. And in that capacity, what I like to do is take a look at, knowledge, and then also what public policymakers have. What kind of knowledge do they have on which to base a decision? And so usually I attempt to study, you know, those kind of critical issues. But before I had formulated this ethic, and it is an ethic, ideology that I have, I had already started to do my research on subsistence and its interrelationship with a cash economy, and also in the context of a contemporary society. This all goes back to the models of change. Just like, you know, the early melting pot theory, where everybody becomes integrated into the larger society, we see where the assumption where subsistence is going to change and become a cash economy. That's a prevalent belief. Now, I at this point in time make no assumption that, you know, someday this is what's going to happen. I don't know that. But what I do know is that it's much more complex
then this simple unilineal model that people don't just go from subsistence to a cash economy.
Okay. Are there examples of societies that have not followed that or transition?
Oh yeah, I mean, you've got lots of here. We've got lots going on right now in Alaska. What I did, okay, there have lots that have you know, come to the cash economy. Okay. But there are others that have survived in a mixed or dual economy. And we have in Alaska many examples of a dual or mixed economy. And you know, in fact, when I started my research on the North Slope, I looked at them historically, and I saw them at four distinct historical periods where they were involved with the larger economic system, but meanwhile protecting their own economic systems. And after the decline of, you know, the commercial whaling period, the trading, fur trading period, the trapping, that was fur trading and trapping, the reindeer herding, after each one of those periods, or what we call boom-bust periods, we see a resurgence or a return to a subsistence economy. Now, everyone will challenge everyone else to say, subsistence cannot be defined. Well, I beg to differ, because I offer at least an outline or a method or a framework to look at subsistence. And I say that subsistence is the appropriation, the distribution, and the utilization of natural resources for the physical, social, and cultural maintenance of a society. Subsistence is the appropriation, the distribution, utilization of natural resources. Necessary for the physical, the social, and cultural maintenance of a society. In this instance, in a subsistence economy, goods and services are reproduced in a repetitive fashion within a structured social organization, or we might say socio-economic organization, according to established customary laws, rules, norms, and values. Now, I know that this is a word that has a lot of emotionalism attached to it, a lot of conflicts, has many different meanings, interpretations. Some people want to take, you know, just only aspects of it. This conflict is also extended in the sciences. And we see that social scientists themselves also have, you know, theoretical differences about what subsistence is. And very basically, we have what we call the formalist economic anthropology, who want to look at economics or subsistence solely in economic terms. And they say that the universal concept of economics can be applied to subsistence economies. On the other hand, we have the substantivists who say that subsistence economy must be analyzed in terms of its social and its cultural context. And myself, I've gone from a substantivist to not a complete formalist, but I do try to take a look at those aspects of subsistence that can be quantified. And in fact, my work out at St. Lawrence Island this past 2 weeks, I attempted to look at man hours, you know, energy expended, total amount of resources that were received, the distribution, but it becomes really difficult. But I did manage to get, you know, man hours, very few women hours in the actual harvesting efforts. But later on in the distribution, they become influential. I always say that the very general assumption about subsistence is that it is an individual hunter pursuing game for physical survival, for basic physical need. But when you start analyzing subsistence systems, you find out indeed that there is a system to it. And so what I try to do is, first of all, I look at the economic aspects. And under the economic aspects, I look at how members of a cultural group pursue, appropriate, and allocate natural resources for food, clothing, shelter, fuel, and other utilitarian items, arts and ceremonial crafts. We see that this economic system can be defined within a specific geographical region, usually the cultural boundaries of a society. So we might have the production occurring in only one geographic region, but we will see that through various kinds of distribution mechanisms that these resources are dispersed to regions beyond the production area. And that's primarily through sharing patterns, trade, and in the later phase, commercial exchange. Associated with the economic sphere of subsistence, we see that there are services that are required to construct or manufacture products derived from the natural resources, or together with material from the commercial market. So in the contemporary period, we see that subsistence economic systems are no longer autonomous. They are no longer that independent unit. But now, in fact, they are interrelated and dependent on a cash economy. And the degree to that dependence over here, that interrelationship, varies from, in the contemporary period, almost from community to community. I have not found an independent, autonomous subsistence unit in Alaska.
When you the defendant, it sounds, seems to imply that if the larger society didn't exist or no longer supplied it, that the economy would not exist anymore. You don't mean that way.
Well, I say that they are dependent on it to acquire the cash for the things that they once formally produced themselves. Whether, you know, depending on where it happened, when it happened, and who was around, you know, they probably, I would say they probably could sustain themselves. You know, but, you know, like the Aleuts. The Aleuts, at, you know, that, you guys know about the, that first seal thing? Where, under the First Seal Act, when they're harvesting for the government, they can use all of the modern technology that they want to. But when it's for their own selves, they have to use, they can't use all the modern technology. They have to use their spears and all of those things. So, you know, it depends on whether the group maintains the kind of knowledge that's necessary to procure their own goods. I would say, like, for the northern groups, the northern and probably, I would say the Bering Straits group, and I don't know about the southwest, I would say that they probably could maintain themselves if snow machines and rifle were removed. I think they have, right now they use a lot, you know, there are some things that they've selected, they use, like the skin boat. They use, they maintain the use of skin boat because functionally it's just much better than the aluminum boat. But they use rifles, where they once used, you know, something else. But I'll tell you, the other thing, when they're whaling, they use these, somebody said, I know the conservation have called them these modern technology. Let me tell you, when you're going out after a 40, 50 foot whale, and you see this guy up there with the harpoon, you know, in bow, trying to plunge this 6 foot harpoon, you know, wooden thing into the bowhead, well, I tell you, that's not modern technology. Yeah, I've been out there on boats when they've done that and prayed for a good strike.
And your relationship with the people from the other side on the subsistence issues, do you find that there's a movement along those lines to require traditional gathering methods?
No.
I know people have
mentioned
it, but I don't know.
Yeah. There has always been that force to try and maintain traditional methods. In fact, if you look at the legislation, a lot of the legislation, they'll say if it's hunted in the traditional manner or procured, you know, and using, making traditional artifacts, handicraft, or whatever. I find it so ironic that on the one instance where subsistence people are trying to maintain themselves, that the government says, nope, you're not allowed to make changes in that sphere. But in this other sphere where we want you to make changes, we're going to support you. In the case of this, the modern technology with the harpoons for the whaling, I think it's really foolish that they haven't been allowed to use something better. I heard an ammunition ammo guy say that those tools are like Neanderthal tools, and it's inefficient. It is inefficient at this point in time.
You know, one thing about that is when they strike a whale, a lot of times they guess they don't live and eat their harpoon, but a lot of times it does seem to be something with the whale. So that's one that died that otherwise, if they would have had to get technology, would have.
That was a common assumption until last year. And this year, when they discovered, you know, first of all, we know that the bombs are effective one-third of the time. And it takes 9-15 bombs to kill a whale, unless it's, you know, they're lucky to get it in the right spot. Also, this last year, they found fragments of old bombs in some way. And the share that I received from Gamba had a healed over bomb wound. And I was working with the scientists out there, the biologists. By the way, all the women, I mean all the scientists who were involved are women in this whaling issue out at the Gamba. Four of us out there.
Where I'm from, like, a lot of the native people there, they...
Where are you from?
From Bethlehem.
Mm-hmm.
And around the region there, mostly that was the problem, like, in the summer, there's people go out and they, they subsist on salmon, they catch it, runs. In the winter, or they spend it really fast in the summer, they just spend on their friends, and fast as it comes in, it goes, and then during the winter, they go on welfare, and they're on a big tooth for all winter, and they're on welfare, and then just the endless cycle, it just keeps going around and around, doesn't seem to click.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a, welfare is just the main, kind of big thing.
Mm-hmm.
They took welfare out, then they wait for the summer and they hold their money. They wouldn't spend it really fast.
Mm-hmm.
So it really breaks the man's pride or something. They just spend on drinking. I don't really care about it too much. Whereas if they didn't have welfare, they'd probably give a lot more thought to where the next meal can come from instead of depending on the government.
So are you saying that this interrelationship, this interdependency in this instance is negative, and maybe we should do something about that interdependency or that interrelationship?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just cut welfare.
Mm-hmm.
Like
you and Reagan.
That's right.
In the winter time, they have welfare. They go out and there's a lot of games. They go out and just on armed in, or they drop the fish they gather in the summer.
Uh-huh.
Or just doesn't happen anymore.
Uh-huh. Go ahead, back there.
What he says is, it isn't really true, because the Bible is true, a lot of people who are available to go to work and then join the community on that.
Uh-huh.
Some people do the welfare.
Uh-huh. Well, let's not talk about psycho-cultural processes now. Let's keep our analysis to economic analysis. I grant that that's true. I don't know how prevalent it is. I haven't seen any studies that say how prevalent it is. Okay. Go ahead, we had another question. Okay, so anyway, when we're looking at subsistence as an economic system, we look at the appropriation of natural resources. We also talk about an interrelationship with the cash economy. And as some of the students have pointed out, some of that interrelationship with the cash economy stems from welfare benefits, unemployment benefits, and in a lot of other places, wage employment. Now, subsistence people have adopted various mechanisms to obtain this cash. Some by welfare, some by unemployment. But other mechanisms also involve individuals, primarily women in a lot of villages, working because the jobs that are available are women. So in some instances, you will have categories, you'll have women working while men are out hunting. Or else another mechanism is to have a brother or one member of the family working, the other member of the family hunting. I don't see a sharing of cash resources,
But what I do see is sharing of equipment. Individual who is a cash earner may purchase equipment, gasoline, ammunition, and provide that subsistence hunter, the active hunter, or I call him the harvester, with those kind of goods, with the expectation that that subsistence person will share those resources with him or her. And I have, you know, any number of cases in this where I've, you know, done my research to see that how that works. We also see the infusion of cash into the subsistence system at another level, and that is the commercial exchange. I've talked about the incorporation of cash into the subsistence market through the reciprocal arrangements between individuals of a subsistence community. Also, we see that there are some people with specialized skills, and these people may sell their subsistence product to other people. I found in my work that there are two types of commercial exchange. One will be to a member of the community at what I call the native price. And this native price is usually lower than a commercial price. And what is involved in this instance is the expectation of a reciprocal pattern where that person, maybe that person, one person might make parkas, another person might make mukluks. I might sell to that person that makes mukluks a parka at a lower price with the expectation that I would be able to buy the mukluks at a lower price. However, I could also sell my parka to somebody outside that system, outside the subsistence system. In that case, the price is usually higher. But there we have a commodity that leaves the subsistence system. But yet the cash is infused back into the subsistence systems and supports that system. I want to talk just a little bit about the social aspects, and when I look at the social aspects, and I'm going to be talking about what the anthropologists call substantivist arguments or premises of subsistence. And in this, when I talk about social, I'm talking about the organization of labor. How do people organize themselves to procure subsistence products? I call